Vrindavan, Vrindavan. Our topic is Vrindavan, and we have approached Vrindavan through Srila Prabhupada. We went over that Chatikara road. Rupa Goswami said that place, Chatikara, a place of many black buzzing bees, just like here. And it said that to the left of Chatikara is Govardhan, and to the right of Chatikara is the lake of Kaliya. And we know that just next to Madan Mohan temple is Kaliya Daha, the place where Krishna danced on the hoots of Kaliya. And we understand the Yamuna used to be there, much closer to Vrindavan, and that gradually the Yamuna has been going at a distance. It said because, Srila Prabhupada explains, because of the Mayavadis that settle in Vrindavan, then the Yamuna is going away from Vrindavan. But then there was a lake, that must have been somewhere in the back of our Krishna Balaram temple, and where Kaliya actually would reside. This pastime of Krishna and Kaliya is interesting because Krishna was very merciful to Kaliya. He's like one demon that he changed. He changed him into a devotee rather than killing them. Yeah? Whereas all the other demons in Vrindavan, they somehow or other were killed, some very quickly. And the main reason why Kaliya was not killed was because of his wives. Because they came as devotees and they prayed to Krishna to somehow or other not kill their husband, because who would maintain them? So then their prayers invoked Krishna's mercy, and then Krishna said, all right, I agree, I will not kill him. Actually, at that stage, Kaliya had been purified by the kicks from Krishna's lotus feet upon his hoots. And Krishna said that, yes, that he was now purified. Then Krishna said that Kaliya could not stay. And that part, I often think about that. In the Nectar of Devotion, there is a portion where it is stated that Krishna is a very pleasing talker. And then the example is given of why Krishna was a pleasing talker. And it said, because of the way he dealt with Kaliya. Imagine that we would have to deal with Kaliya. Some nasty, poisonous snake, right? Who has just killed all your friends. Right? But okay, you've revived them. And now you've taught the snake a lesson. Right? And okay, you know, you were just about to finish him off. And then his wives came and start crying and everything. And what are you going to do now? So he said, okay, snake. Now you listen, you know. I won't kill you. But one thing you got to know, you know, that you're going to get out of this town, you snake. And if you ever dare to show your snaky face again in this town, you know, then, you know, next time you're finished, you got it. And now dance, you snake. Dance, 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 right? And Kaliya would have danced the whole way. And at a distance, Kaliya would have turned around, shaked his fist, and said, I'll get your back, Swami. I'll get your back. Right? And I think that's probably how I would have dealt with such a snake. I don't know how any of you would have. But, you know, I would have. Yes, oh yes. This town ain't big enough for the two of us. And you gotta go. So that was basically Krishna's message. Krishna's message was basically, this town is not big enough for the two of you, two of us. You have to go. So, all right, you know. But Krishna did it nice. First of all, he said, my dear king of the snakes. So, oh, he thinks I'm a king. That's nice. So Kali already felt a little better. He said, my dear king of the snakes, there is no need to fear anything. There's no need to fear anything because everything is arranged. You simply, you can go now back to your island, Ramanaka Island, because my footprints are on your head. I know you came here because Kaliya, because Garuda was chasing you, but there is no problem. You can return to your island. Garuda will not touch you because my lotus feet are on your head. The prints are there. So in this way, Kaliya was protected, and then Kaliya returned to his home, which is now the island of Fiji. And there, in ISKCON Fiji, they do have a temple of Krishna dancing on the hoots of Kaliya. There Kaliya is supposed to be still present, living in the deep sea. Srila Prabhupada said. So, interesting how we have no idea. This is one aspect in Krishna consciousness, is that the hidden part of reality. Prabhupada would say so many things about the hidden part of reality. Like one thing is that Prabhupada said that mosquitoes, plenty here in this camp, when they sting you, Prabhupada said what they do is they use the pore holes in the skin. They actually don't make new holes, but they use the existing holes. Makes sense. Why would they drill new holes if there are already holes there? Yeah. But yes, yeah, so the whole skin is full of holes, and so they used one of the existing holes and then put their syringe inside. So that's interesting. It's just something nobody's ever told us, but makes sense. Makes sense. Prabhupada said about frogs, he said that yogis and frogs are just the same. Whenever you meet a yogi, you can tell the yogi about that, that there's actually no difference between yogis and frogs. And then Prabhupada explained, he said the yogis, they are controlling their breath, and in the process of controlling their breath, they are perfecting the art, and they learn how to bring about a balance between the ingoing air and the outgoing air. And once these airs are brought into balance, then one comes to a stage of kumbhaka, and one can stop breathing for quite a long period of time. And he said yogis know this art, and therefore sometimes you have some super yogi who gets himself buried under the ground, and he stays there for a week, and then they dig him back up, and he comes out alive. The Prabhupada said, in the same way, the frogs, they also can know this art of kumbhaka, of bringing the balance between the ingoing breath, and then they can stay underwater for a long time. Therefore, there is no difference between yogis and frogs. And you can tell that to the yoga teachers. They're just frogs. Just that you know, right? Have to know that she's a yoga teacher. In other words, to spell it out for you, you are a frog. Just see. So, but in this way, Srila Prabhupada had these unique, these unique little bits of information that nobody knew. Which is very interesting, and it is a fact. How much do we know of reality? Only So little, actually. How much do we know? Prabhupada told us that dinosaurs are actually lizards. He's saying that in the Kali Yuga, the lizards and the insects, they become bigger and bigger. And gradually you get like dragonflies, right, that are like with 1.5 meter, right? Maybe some guys will be riding on them, you know, instead of a motorboat. And is that insects can grow in size, and also dinosaurs are just lizards that have become big. And so they become bigger, and human beings become smaller. We remember that from Krishna's pastimes, that human beings become smaller as the yugas are moving along. And it is stated that actually in the previous yugas, in the previous yuga, previous to the appearance of Krishna, people were about 5 to 6 meters tall. And there is that story of Revati, who was the daughter of King Revata. And King Revata was looking everywhere for a suitable husband, couldn't find one. And then he decided to go up to Lord Brahma to consult Brahma, who could be a suitable husband somewhere in the universe, suitable for his daughter. So then, as they were in the court of Lord Brahma, they had to wait a little bit. And a lot of, when they returned, a lot of time had passed by. And all the princes they used to know, everyone had died. All the family had died. Not only that, the yuga had changed. And everyone was much smaller. So here was this girl, about 5-6 meters tall, and there was like no husband for her in the right size, right? So they didn't know what to do. But then finally, Lord Balaram was the choice, right? And Lord Balaram, with his plow, he pulled her down. And he reached out with his plow, and he just pulled down and brought her down to a suitable size, and then married her. So, yeah, just see how, in how it was in different yugas. Archaeologists never come up with such ideas. They never thought of that, you know, about that possibility, that there are different yugas and people of different size. In this way, reality is so much more colorful, so much more rich than what is presented to us as normal, ordinary facts, right? Therefore, science has a lot of limitations, because science is approaching the past from the present reality. Possibly the present reality is very different from the past. Doesn't mean that, therefore, we can understand. But from a lot of historical sources, you get a lot of common information. For example, in ancient Persia, there was a culture, and that was known as the Zoroastrian culture, and they were worshipping Zarathustra. Yes. So, in that culture of Persia, they have their scriptures. So these scriptures are still available. There is an Oxford-produced website called sacredtext.com, and there's a lot of sacred texts from the whole world are there, big collection. So, okay, I look at that site sometimes, and I checked out the Zoroastrian scriptures, and I was reading them just anywhere, and suddenly I was reading about a tree with four different roots. It said a golden root, a silver root, a copper root, and the iron root. And it said these roots, they were representing the four ages: the golden age, the silver age, the iron age, or the copper age, the iron age. So, you know, when you read that as a devotee, you go like, sounds quite familiar. Then it was describing that in the previous age, there was a class of people, they would wear a string around their waist, and they would perform yasna, string around the waist and yasna. What would that mean? So, like this, we can appreciate that obviously once there was one world culture. In England, we have these we have Stonehenge. And Stonehenge is just one of the mysteries of the world. People say, well, something ancient, something religious, or whatever it was. But, you know, in old times, clearly, these stones were put in some formation by human beings, apparently. Once our Sadaputta, who was undoubtedly the greatest scientist ISKCON ever had, unfortunately he left this planet, but Sadaputta, he once organized a film, and it showed footage of Yantar Mantar. You have heard of Yantar Mantar? Yantar Mantar is found either in Delhi, there is a Yantar Mantar, or in Jaipur, there is a Yantar Mantar. In Jaipur, it's right next to the Govindaji Temple. In Delhi, it's right next to Connaught Place. Yantar Mantar. And it is a Vedic observatory. What you see is different arches, or some staircases, or all different ways that they used to measure the stars, the position of the stars. And through that, you know, certain stars should be at a certain time in a certain place. And then, so there was there's a formation of columns in Yantar Mantar, and by these columns you get the positions of different planets. So they all line up at a particular time. And then they saw that the formation of that Yantar Mantar, of the columns, was exactly the same as the formation of Stonehenge. Same direction, same distances. So they came to the conclusion Stonehenge is actually a Vedic observatory. And then they started to look at Stonehenge like that. But they saw that it didn't completely match the position of some of the planets. Said, yeah, over time you have to make some adjustments. Yes. So then they calculated it back, when this would have been accurate. And when they calculated back, when this would have been accurate, it came to 17,000 years. Stonehenge is a Vedic observatory which is 17,000 years old. Just now you know. So we see there's a lot of hidden knowledge in the world which is all pointing at that forgotten culture. You know, forgotten culture. Like in South Africa, where I regularly preach, then the African people, they're mainly interested in ancestor worship. They say the ancestors stay with us, and some are favorable, some are not favorable, and you have to pacify them. And that's basically what they do. But in the old time, it was not just like that. It said in the old time, They were worshipping one god, right, who was known as Ulunkulu. Ulunkulunkulu, excuse me. Ulunkulunkulu. Yeah? So, Ulunkulunkulu, it's a very cool name for God. It is said, one of the meanings of Ulunkulunkulu is he who has the most cows. Isn't it nice? That's a nice meaning. Krishna has the most cows. Just see. So we like that name. Cool name. So the whole world has these fragments. We see many Turkish warriors with sikhs, and we have these stories of Indiana Jones Swami or Indrajumda Maharaj, who always has an adventure. Every day in his life is an adventure. And he describes how he was in Russia and how at that time they asked him to meet a professor because the government was investigating the roots of the movement, if it was bona fide or not. And the professor was advising the government, so maybe Maharaj could sort of put in a good word with the professor. So he went to that professor, and he was sort of trying to explain, yes, actually we're not a new movement, we're an old tradition, and so on, from the Vedas. The professor goes like, we know all that. We know all that. He said, that's not the question. He said, the question is, where did the Vedic culture really begin? In India or in the Volga region? He says, because, he says, there is a book which is as old as Russia, the Russian Veda. And the hero of this book is a person named Kishan. Kishan, wait a minute. Hey, you know, I mean, Kishan. Many people are called Kishan in India. Kishan Lal is a very common name, Kishan. Yeah? And it is another name of Krishna, Kishan. So what is this? Yes, it said, and then it's described how this Kishan, when he was young, that he danced on the hoots of a snake and killed the snake. Hey, this is plagiarism. We have copyright. Wait a minute. What's going on? You know, ho, 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 ho. BBT production, huh? Yes. What's happening here? This is taking too far, you know. Russian Veda. But it is interesting to see that actually so much Vedic culture was there in Russia. And then you have this Baku, right? And in Baku, you have a fire. You have a place where there is gas coming out of the ground, and it is burning. So they've built a temple on that place with double walls. So there's the inside of the temple, and then in space in between the walls, second walls, and the fire, the gas, goes in between the walls, and it comes out at the top. So it looks pretty exciting. And this temple is dedicated to Agni. And the pujaris, traditionally, are coming from India. Even up to the day of today, pujaris from India are maintaining the puja in that place. It's just one of those things, you know, which hint of a past that is now no longer remembered, but that clearly point at the Vedic culture. So we can see that the roots of Krishna consciousness were once spread all over the world, and at once there indeed was a world culture. So when Prabhupada used to say that once the Pandavas were the rulers of the entire world, right, that it's not so awkward, actually, as it may sound. You know, like here you are, Once upon a time, dear people, Yudhisthira Maharaj was the emperor of the whole world. You know, like, sometimes I was in a university and I gave this presentation and about Krishna consciousness and in an intricate way, you know, suitable for university. And then at the end, some professor comes to me and says, like, that was damn good. That was damn good, you know. That was damn good. You might have asked your question, you know. It was damn good. Might have asked your question. I said, no, go ahead. He says, do you really believe all this? It was damn good, but whether I really believe all this. So sometimes what we accept for granted is so far away from the common world view of today that people are just like, I mean, you really believe all this? Come on, I mean, you really believe all this? You know, I mean, you believe all this? Yeah. But why not? There are sometimes mentioned in scriptures 33 crores of demigods, or sometimes Prabhupada says 33 million demigods, whatever the number is. 33 crores is 10 more. But anyway, 10 more, 10 less. So there are 33 principal demigods, such as Agni and Vayu and Surya and so on, Indra. These are the principal demigods. There are 33 of them. Then these have so many assistants. And some are having like smaller parts to play. They used to have, in the north of England, in somewhere in the Scottish regions, they used to have a place which became very famous. It was known as Findhorn. And this place, Findhorn, was interesting because what they were doing, they were worshipping devatas, divine beings. And they said that everywhere there are little divine beings that protect the forces in nature, that protect the plants, that protect the forest. Every little tree has its own protector. Right? And then they started worshipping them. And suddenly they started to grow plants that usually, and fruits that usually don't grow in Scotland, which is a cold place, by the way, and very high also, the highlands, right? So everything started to grow there, out of season, and very big and nice flowers, fruits, and all kinds of things that didn't grow there normally. And people would go from everywhere to Findhorn to see the miracle. And, well, yeah, that's not at all out of order. It is Christianity that has destroyed the concept of the demigods, actually, in the Western world. And now the idea of demigods is something strange. But before, that was normal. Elves and dwarves and all these creatures, totally acceptable and normal. And actually, we find sometimes references to such kind of creatures. We also find references to, like, evil creatures, evil type of dwarves, right? And all the old fairy tales are back, you know, in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that is very interesting, right? That, like, Srimad Bhagavatam, this whole reality is this mystic reality that we are facing is there. But that we find historically so many remnants of that. In relation to Lord Chaitanya's movement, I was interested to research a little bit how Islam covered the original culture of Southeast Asia. Yeah? And then the same for Buddhism. So one can see, one can trace out dates, right? How kings in Java, how one prince in Java became a convert to Islam. And he came back to force Islam upon his whole family. And it became a big thing, but he succeeded. And eventually, and Java went and became a Mohammedan island, as it is now, right? At that particular point. In East Bengal, in Bangladesh, we see it I think 1196. In 1196, the Muslims conquered Nadia and they defeated the Sena kings. The Sena kings, they were very powerful Kshatriyas, and they had a big army. And a relatively small group of Muslims, they defeated them. How? Because they didn't fight on principles, on Kshatriya principles. They didn't come and they didn't openly challenge. Rather, they sneaked in the city like horse salesmen. And they came into the city of Nadia like horse salesmen. And then, once they were inside, right, they were in the palace. And then, by treacherous means, they took control of the state. So we can see that the very powerful Vedic king became defeated because of the Kali Yuga style of war, which he just couldn't relate to because he was such a noble Kshatriya. But then, then Islam got hold in Bengal, but not all of Bengal. There were still districts in Bengal under Hindu kings, and several districts stayed under Hindu kings for a long time. And some flipped back and forth. Some were sometimes with the Hindu kings, some don't. So, little by little, we can see how the original culture became covered. How gradually, and then Islam began to wipe out history. In Bangladesh, for example, one has to really search, one has to dig for the history of Gaudiya Vaishnavism. But it's there, it's our place. It's all there, but it's a little hidden. Same in Java, and same in places like Cambodia, in Angkor Wat. But clearly the Ramayana is all over Angkor Wat's walls, right? Carved in the stone, it's still there. It's very clearly Hindu and not Buddhist, there's no doubt about it. We see in Indonesia, they have these amazing Ramayana performances. They train people for a very long time. Yeah? They train all kinds of dancers and actors for a very, very long time to act out the Ramayana. An ancient tradition, ancient culture. So, these are just like Manipur has its tradition, and then you have this Chetak dance, where you see all these. This Chetak dance, you can see how hundreds of people, they sit there, and there is one man who's leading them, and they go in some sort of trance all together. And the leader is beginning to make some sort of sounds, And they all go for it. And then they all bow over at the same time. And you look at it, and you think, my God, what kind of weird ritual is this? What kind of weird ritual is this? I mean, look at it, Religion in the world has the strangest things. But then when you investigate it better, then you see, this is us. This is us, yeah? This is us, because this is the Ramayana. They have this dance and they're acting out the Ramayana, the army of monkeys. And they do good monkeys, actually. But this is our culture. So it is very interesting if we just go around the world and reclaim our culture. And the more we reclaim our culture, the more we actually see that there is very much a historical foundation of our movement around the world. And I thought, just to say a few things on that today. Don't know why. Just came in my head. To sort of show that the otherworldly side of Krishna consciousness, the fairy tale like side of Krishna consciousness, is actually much more reality than people generally think it is. And in the same way, the kind of otherworldly aspect of Vrindavan, the fairy tale like invisible Vrindavan world, is actually much more a reality than we think it is. With that, 2 o'clock has come, and with that, it is goodbye, Balkan. Love you so much. See you later. I'm soon gonna get out of here. What to do? We must move on. But maybe meet again somewhere. Maybe next time in Vrindavan. Why not? Because if you're not thinking about going Vrindavan, then you're not thinking. If you're not dreaming about going to Vrindavan, then you're dead like a stone. Yeah. If you're not somehow or other planning and scheming to go to Vrindavan, then what are you doing anyway? We must go to Vrindavan. Yeah, there is no doubt about it. We must go. We must roll in the dust. We must. We must taste the Mahaprasadam. We must jump in the Yamuna. Yeah, but is the Yamuna still there? Of course it is. On the spiritual platform, it is still there. It's only the external covering of the dam that can be affected by a dam in Delhi. See, the eternal Yamuna is eternally there. The dam is eternally there. The dam cannot disappear, no matter what human beings put on top of it. Even if we get the Vrindavan Hilton, it is still Vrindavan. Right? The Yamuna can never leave Vrindavan. Still, we would like the covering of Vrindavan to be as transparent as possible to the eternal Vrindavan. And that is our service. Our movement has that service in Vrindavan. I've meditated on this a lot when I was temple president, that our service is to make sure that the covering of Vrindavan becomes as transparent as possible to the eternal Vrindavan. And therefore Dham Seva is important, and therefore the Yamuna campaign is also a good thing, but foreigners must be careful, because we don't want to become blacklisted in terms of visa. We need to, so let the Indians go in front. But we want the Yamuna back in Delhi. But even if in the covering of Vrindavan there are so many irregularities now, underneath, the eternal Vrindavan is unchanged and still there. Therefore, we must go. We must go. And don't say, oh, where are the peacocks now? They are there. We just need the eyes to see them. The eternal peacocks. the ones that danced with Krishna, the ones that when Krishna played his flute danced so enthusiastically and so happily that afterwards Krishna bowed before them like a musical performing, and then the peacocks gracefully presented him with a gift, one of their feathers, and Krishna accepted it and put it on his head. That Vrindavan is there for us to see. It just depends on the purity of our heart. So now we can prepare and try to become purified so that when we go to Vrindavan, we can actually perceive the transcendental spiritual world. Hare Krishna. Thank you so much. I'm too tired for questions. I have a cold. So forgive me. I'll just escape. I have some hot soup. Okay. Srila Prabhupada. Ki jai.